factories set up on the upper Manhattan. And so Jimmy had said to Nikolai, Nick, it's like a little mini synthesizer. Well, what made that possible was the invention of transistors. Mm-hmm. So anyway, this is not one event, but what this led to building this first large-scale installation there in the basement of the Annenberg School. And I just blithely, knowing nothing about it, said, oh, yes, I'll have an electronic piece on the for the Philadelphia Composers Forum next fall. So lo and behold, I just went into the studio and found many, many sounds that I liked.
And that was the
I mark that as the beginning of my professional life as a composer, because I was on this program. The three people on the program were Vincent Persichetti with the piano quintet, and George Crumb, who had just come to the area to become the faculty at Penn. He played the piano in one of his own night music for violin piano.
Sure.
And then I, the young unknown guy, you know, even Crumb was not so well known in those days. This was in the days before Ancient Voices of Children and other before his Pulitzer Prize and what have you. So here we were. So Persichetti's the big name on the program. I'm the total unknown. And here I present this electronic piece with film accompaniment. And I got this great write-up in the paper. And I learned even then how generous Crumb was, you know, because in the Q&A afterwards, of course, everybody was intrigued with the novelty of the film and electronic piece. And anyway, so that's a very important breakthrough for me.
Sure.
And another startling thing in connection with that was when I found out that portions of that, that led to the commission from Nonesuch of my Tragedia, which is a full-length LP of synthesizer music. And when I found out, a friend called me up and said, oh, I saw a pre-screening of the new Fellini movie.
Yes.
I knew you
were going to talk about that. I knew.
I see you have a screen credit. I said, yeah. I do. You know, I was really startled to find out that portions of that Tragedia album have become part of the soundtrack of Fellini's Satyricon. There is no film director in the entire world today that I admire more than Fellini. And the idea that I would be even a tiny footnote of some sort in his
wonderful.
In his, I still get every year a royalty check for my small contribution to that film.
Exciting.
One year it'll be $71. Another year it'll be $8.50.
Well, you can go buy some coffee.
Exactly.
Or you could just have some fun.
But that was a thrilling thing to me to find that I was somehow linked
part
to
of
Federico Fellini,
sure.
One of my great idols.
Well, you know, this is going back to your early days. And now we're going to go back to, in general, now.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about social media for just a moment, literally just a moment, to keep this up to date, I guess. Many composers are involved with it, Facebook, Twitter, what have you. Has social media helped you, and in what ways, do you think?
Well, it's interesting, especially, you know, people talk incessantly about Facebook and usually oh, it's such a waste of time. It's just people posting pictures of their cats and what have you. I don't agree. I was involved in the days before Facebook on AOL. There used to be a classical bulletin board. And it was amazing. A bunch of us became friends through that. That's where I first came to know Jennifer Higdon, through a forum on that board. And a composer who uses this internet name of Yanni Bigood, he calls himself. His name is Daryl Katz, a wonderful jazz composer who teaches at Berklee College, and we became friends through that. But on the Opera Oasis section of this, you could talk to Samuel Ramey, Susan Graham, all sorts of people.
Yeah,
and I became friends there with the wonderful dramatic soprano now coming really into the big time, Christine Gerkey. And we used to. So some of this transferred over onto Facebook. I have to tell you, if you want to know about what impact it's had.
Yeah.
We're going to hear part of my piano concerto, and that was premiered originally in Washington D.C. But Marc Antonio Baroni, who played the soloist part, came back to Philadelphia and said, "You know, we've got to do this work in Philadelphia." So a concert was planned with Orchestra 2001. To present that, and I forget which season it was, but when we got near the time for the rehearsals to begin, a foundation that had previously funded us rather generously, we were now in the midst of the recession, and all of a sudden we were wondering where the money was going to come from, and whether we should present only one performance of it or maybe postpone it till next season. And we decided ultimately, well, let's throw ourselves on the mercy of our patrons. So I personally sent out notices telling people that I'm counting on having this performance in order to get a recording of it to put out. If you can help us in any way, you will. Anyone who makes a contribution specifically to support this recording will have their name included in the album and will be listed as donors at the performance. On the internet, two people that I knew only through Facebook each sent me $1,000.
Yeah, you see.
One from Australia. When he called me up to tell me it was coming by Western Union, specifically to me, because he couldn't send a Western Union money order to an organization, he told me how much he was sending, I burst into tears. I couldn't imagine that such a thing would happen. So don't tell me it's a trivial thing.
It works.
From that rather mercenary end, I've retained a friendship with these people, and one of them is a fellow in Virginia who works for the Department of Homeland Security, but is also a pianist. Mm-hmm. And we got to be friends because we had both studied with Stockhausen.
Oh.
And he and a cellist down in Virginia are planning a performance of my cello sonata in October. So
it works.
It's
valuable.
It's terrific.
Well,
I
let's go.
It.
We're going to hear one movement, the last movement from this piano concerto.
Right.
And let's. Do you want to go right to it, and we can?
Yeah, I'll just say it's a rondo.
Sure. Okay.
And it exists in another version for two pianos, where it's called Overture Rondo. So that'll be coming out also on a recording of my piano music that's in preparation now. But I originally thought this was the opening movement of this concerto, and after I wrote the second movement, I thought, no, this belongs after
at
that.
At the end.
And and it sat with only the two movements. Susan Starr was the person originally who inspired my notion to write this concerto, but that never came to be. And I ultimately completed the piece by writing the first movement, and Marc Antonio Baroni gave the first performance down at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, and then later this recording that's recorded here with Orchestra 2001 in Philadelphia.
So we hear it now. This is the last movement from Andrew Rudin's Concerto for Piano and Small Orchestra, a work from 2008.
Thank you.
You were just listening to music by my guest, Andrew Rudin. That was the final movement from his Concerto for Piano and Small Orchestra, dating from 2008. In our performance, you heard piano soloist Marcantonio Baroni, along with Orchestra 2001. James Freeman was the conductor, a Centaur compact disc, music of Andrew Rudin. Well, today we are celebrating the 75th birthday of American composer Andrew Rudin, who is here in the WPRB studio and will be here until 11 o'clock. Andrew, once again, thank you so much for sharing this time here on the program.
What a great opportunity, Marvin. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And, well, we're going to go now to your piano sonata in just a few minutes, but just say a couple brief words about self-publishing, which
well,
you do.
I think this is one of the great things that composers can do now. And increasingly, even people of much wider and larger reputation than I choose to be their own self-publishers rather than now it seems that the traditional publishing houses, if you are taken in and made part of their roster, there's a certain prestige that goes with that. But most composers I know are rather unhappy with their relationships with such publishing houses. The pieces that I do have with some of the major publishers, I feel like they, well, publishing, what does that mean? Publishing means making public, doesn't it?
Right.
It means putting it out where the public can get
That's
at
right.
it.
That's right.
Well, I feel like in most cases that my experience, they put it into print and then they warehoused it. And it's out in the Midwest somewhere in boxes in a warehouse. You can get it if you know the code, you know what number it is, and you are willing to. And then on top of it, what comes to me as a royalty is minuscule. Almost all profits, if there are any, go to the publisher, and they don't. Unless you are already rather famous, they don't do much to advocate on your behalf. So self-publishing, the computer, of course, has made all this possible. I want to tell you about a most interesting thing that I've just gotten involved in. A fellow who was a student at our school, I don't remember what it was called in those days, probably the Philadelphia College of Performing Arts. this fellow's name is Michael Calkin. He's a composer, and he has started a very ingenious publishing idea online called Swirly Music. You can look it up, swirlymusic.com. Mm-hmm. And what you see there is those of us who are on his roster.
Right.
You see our complete piece there. You can peruse the entire score online. You can hear recordings, see interviews, read reviews of it, read reactions of other people. And if you then wish to purchase it, you can do so. And it's arranged in such a way that although you can peruse the score, you cannot simply download it yourself.
That's what I was going to ask you.
But the idea that you can look at the thing, hear it through a recording.
That's a great improvement.
Exactly. It's a very flexible and ingenious way of doing things. And what does anybody have to lose? And then most of the a substantial amount of the profit comes back to the composer himself. So the idea that we can now make our own high print quality engraving through the computer programs. Of course, the two big ones are still Finale and Sibelius. And there are constantly the wars between those two camps. But the scores that come out look in every way as good as
What comes out from a publisher.
If you were meticulous about it and you were willing to. So I've been very happy to be able to print my own music and simply distribute it to anyone who contacts me and wants to have it. There's no middleman then. Profit there is,
that's yours.
It belongs to me.
That's right.
So I like that.
Sounds good. Well, one piece of yours that is self-published is your piano sonata.
That's correct.
And we're going to hear the entire thing. This is a work from 2013.
Yeah, I wrote it last January.
And Beth Levin is the pianist. Tell us about her skill and the work a little bit itself.
Well, Beth is another one of these Facebook contacts. I was first put in contact with her hearing her wonderful recording of the Goldberg Variations and then later Beethoven's Die Belle Variations. She's a remarkable pianist, was at Marlborough and was a pupil of Rudolf Serkin and Leonard Shure, and plays a lot of chamber music. She lives in Brooklyn and works at the Brooklyn Conservatory of Music. She also is an avid explorer of all things artistic, and she makes many posts online of paintings, poems, quotes from novels, anything that interests her. And one day she had posted something about Wallace Stevens, and it so struck me that I contacted her and said, oh, I really love that, and mm-hmm. reminded me I must read Wallace Stevens again. And so then the next thing I know, she wants to see some of my music. And then not too long after that, she played three portrait miniatures of mine at a concert at Barge Music, where I and Scott Wheeler had these little portrait pieces and then had to be followed by Beethoven's monumental Die Belle Variation. So we look like real pygmies next to that mountain, you know. But so Beth has become a real champion of my music and has played in a number of my chamber pieces. Here's the absurd thing. I entered the world of music through the piano, and yet I have never written I've never written something as simple as a piano sonata. The only major piano work I wrote for Lydia Artemu back in 1975, a work called Museum Pieces. But I just wanted to write a conventional sonata, you know. Knowing Beth's particular personality and skills and what she could do, I had her very much in mind when I. Oh, and she had told me she was planning to give a concert last May 5th, Cinco de Mayo, mm-hmm. and she was going to include David Del Tredici and Yehudi Weiner and Scott Wheeler, and I forget who else. She was also going to play Brahms and Schubert. And she said, I'd love to have something from you. So I decided I would write this sonata for her, and she gave the premiere of it on Cinco de Mayo, 2013. So I wrote this piece at the McDowell Colony in the January of that year, and then in May she gave the premiere. So we've now recorded it, and there is a projected compilation of my various piano works, of which this will be a major component. And we're still trying to figure out, I want to include the museum pieces, but don't yet have the pianist for that. There will be two piano works and a couple, and even I'm going to even play myself on the album of a couple of short, small pieces.
So, nice.
Anyway, but Beth, you'll hear particularly the finale. when I first heard it, she managed to take it at such a clip that I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it could even be played this fast. It's really quite dazzling, and you'll see from the recording how marvelously she acquits herself with it.
Well, we listen now to Beth Levin perform Andrew Rudin's piano sonata dating from 2013.
Thank you.
Music by my guest, Andrew Rudine. You were just listening to his piano sonata dating from 2013 as performed by Beth Levin. Well, Andrew, we don't have too much time and we still want to talk briefly about your electronic music. However, let's go to the coming months of 2014, upcoming months. What's happening in the future?
Well, as I told you, I decided that I get to claim the whole year. So there's a lot of stuff coming up. In October, there are two premieres, a work of mine for string orchestra called September Trilogy, which is actually a commemorative piece for 9/11. This will be given its first performance by Orchestra 2001. Mm. So there'll be performances in both Philadelphia and Swarthmore.
Nice.
And I hope to make a recording of that.
Nice.
Too good to let that get away.
Sure.
And so I'm greatly looking forward to that, because actually it's a piece I wrote in 2007 and it hasn't is only till now getting its first performance.
Wow.
So I'm really enthusiastic to hear that. And another thing in that same month, in Dallas at SMU, there's a new music ensemble called Voices of Change. They have a rather extensive series, and the woman there, Maria Schleuning, violinist with the Dallas Symphony, directs that ensemble, and she included my violin sonata last season on a program that was mostly featuring music of Derek Bermel. And but she then told me, "Oh, I really, really like your music, but I chose the violin sonata because I selfishly wanted to play it myself," she said.
Oh.
So that was a nice compliment.
Sure.
But she said, "I'd love to do something else." So anyway, I am writing a piece for her called Dreaming at the Wheel. It uses the same instrumentation as Ravel's Mallarmé songs, but these are four Texas poems, poems by Texas poet Charles Balin, and they come from a volume of his poetry called Dreaming at the Wheel, and I have adopted that as the title for my piece as well. I'm using the same instrumentation as Ravel's Mallarmé songs because I just worship that piece and have always wanted to make my own Texas-tinged
yeah.
version of it. But I'm also, I have added to his instrumentation one percussionist.
Yeah.
But so I'm greatly looking forward to that. That'll also be in October. And the viola sonata that we're going to hear a movement from, I'm hoping that, Brett Dubner and Marcantonio Baroni, who recorded this after having given performances of it, I think back in 2009, both of them play for the Lenape Chamber Ensemble, which you might know plays in the Bucks County area. And this is directed by Mary Eleanor Pitcairn, who, by total coincidence of things, was a student colleague of mine at the University of Texas. We were both cellists, and we both studied with the wonderful old French cellist Horace Brit. And Mary Eleanor and I reconnected, and she programmed my cello sonata last year and has expressed interest in it seems like a natural sense. Both Brett and Marcantonio are now fixtures of the Lenape Chamber Ensemble. So we're hoping that that will come about, but that's not definite yet. But so it's interesting how all these connections
are coming together.
Yeah, and I also have a piano trio in the works for Lloyd Smith, Nancy Bean, and again Marc Antonio Baroni for the group called 1807 and Friends.
Oh yeah, sure.
And
sure.
I'm hoping to go away this coming fall and complete that composition, and then we'll see what happens there. But Lloyd is one of the people who got taken with my cello sonata and gave a wonderful performance of it at 1807 and Friends, and that led to our wanting to do something more for their trio. So I'm very excited. I got a whoever would have imagined in my 70s I would have this kind of flowering. So
well, I could see the flowering in your smile too.
Well, there's great. a lot to smile about. I'm in good health, and
yeah, you are. You certainly are.
I'm having more opportunities than ever before. Yeah. So don't go by any predetermined notion of how other people's careers have played out. If someone had told me when I was 50 I'd be doing this at 70, I would have not believed it.
Well, believe it. There it is. And like I say, you're still smiling. Andrew, so we're going to hear the first movement of the viola sonata now, right?
That's correct.
Okay, and again, our performers are violist Brett Dubner and pianist Marc Antonio Baroni. Music by Andrew Rudine. Thank you. Music by my guest, Andrew Rudine. You were just listening to the first movement of his Sonata for Viola and Piano. You heard violist Brett Dubner along with pianist Marc-Antonio Baroni, and that's from an upcoming release on the Centaur label. Well, we just have a few minutes left, and well, Andrew, before we sign off, I just want to first of all say thank you, and once again, happy birthday.
Well, going full speed ahead here.
And so go for the whole year.
Looking forward to it. Yeah. Thank you so much, Marvin. It's been great.
You've been just a delight, and you always are when you come here. We have such a great time. And I just want to also mention that on the playlist for today's program will be a link to your website.
Oh, terrific.
So if people have more information about you.
You can find me on YouTube as well.
And YouTube. And, you know, if anybody wants to share the playlist or whatever, just share it. Post, you know. And, you know, and my website is www.classicaldiscoveries.org. If you have any comments or questions, drop me an email at marvinrosen@classicaldiscoveries.org. And, also, the MP3 audio sound files for today's entire program will be posted by this evening. Well, Andrew, a brief word about your electronic music. We're going to kind of fade away with your first piece that got you into composition. Is this really like your
first?
Well,
no, this the piece we're going to hear is not my very first one.
Yeah.
Actually, after the first electronic piece that I made was a piece with film and tape together that was seen at Bauerberg. Incidentally, both of my film and tape pieces are now available on YouTube. Anybody wants to listen and look there, very easy to find. You just put my name in, and I have a channel there, and you'll see the two the two early electronic works. But this is from dancers began to be very interested in electronic music because, of course, it didn't require live performers. Mm-hmm. The music could be changed quickly and easily. It was also a very hot thing in the mid-60s to have electronics. And they loved the fact also that since it was created on tape, it never varied, so they didn't have to worry about, you know, one night the conductor speeded up and another night he slowed down. So they liked that. And yeah. I got many commissions from prominent dancers. And this is an excerpt from a full evening dance piece that was presented at Westbeth by Dance Theater Workshop. Jeff Duncan choreographed it, and he was the founder of Dance Theater Workshop, which continues to be one of the most important mm-hmm. places for experimental dance in Manhattan. What they did was that a group of choreographers got together, and they formed a company for each other. So I'll dance in your piece if next week you'll dance in mine. And so Jeff made this full evening piece called View. And I did the score for it. It was quadraphonic, actually. It was presented in the round. God. And the original recording of it was made the sounds swirl around the audience, cut diagonally across the space,
sometimes
locate specifically in some area. And so it was a lot of fun to do that. And what we're going to hear as we're going out here is called Men's Dance from View. It's a bouncy... well, close as I ever came to disco, I guess.
Oh, well, we're going to fade out with this. We probably won't have a chance to hear the whole thing.
Exactly.
But people will get the idea. And Andrew, once again, it was a pleasure.
Pleasure was most definitely mine, Martin.
It was fun. We had a lot of fun. Here we go. Thank you.